From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
El Cerrito,
Union Square,
San Francisco,
South of Market,
from Albany,
Hayes Valley,
Rock Ridge, in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, we'll look at the role young people played in the recent election and what role they'll play in the future.
This is a political group that needs to be courted and engaged and listened to, and policies need to be put in place that serve their needs. And if you do that, they'll support you.
Then we'll look at another type of support, rehabilitation opportunities inside of prison.
When you come up here, it's like you're not even in prison for a minute. It makes you feel like a normal person.
And we'll celebrate Veterans Day with a local program that helps vets handle post-traumatic stress.
This has been a wonderful opportunity for me to come here and sort of tone down the powder keg that some of us walk around with.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. In 2008, 18 to 29-year-olds voted in record numbers. But this time around, youth turnout was expected to be way, way down.
A Harvard poll released last month indicated that less than half of the so-called millennial generation say they will definitely cast a vote tomorrow. That's down from 63% at this time 4 years ago.
Despite all the talk of this enthusiasm gap, an estimated 22 to 23 million young voters turned out. That's actually a little bit more than in 2008. Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo looks into why people underestimated young voters and what we can expect from those voters in the future.
Felicia Sullivan is a researcher at Circle, the premier polling organization tracking youth and politics.
We were actually prepared to tell a story of why did youth turnout not, you know, be at the level that it was in 2008. And we don't have that story to tell. We have a better story.
What Sullivan means is that her organization and pretty much everybody expected fewer young people to vote this election, which wasn't the case. We'll come back to that later. That's what it sounded like on the campus of UC Berkeley the night Barack Obama was first elected 4 years ago. And on November 6th, 2012, it sounded pretty much the same. Yet, when I talked to students just before the election, most admitted to being less engaged and less hopeful this time around. Savea Joaquino is a freshman at Cal.
Hope, it's something everybody wants and, this, giant dream, and, when you think of it, it seems so perfect. But, it's really hard to achieve anything when our political system is like this.
What would it look like if, Obama ran on hope this time?
I don't think he could do that again.
Joaquino supported the president, but said it was dangerous for him to become the poster boy for hope back in 2008 because it made it way too easy for young people to get their hopes dashed.
To me, nobody deserves my hope, because not one person on earth can prove they so. Nobody.
20-year-old Joshua Clayton lives 6 miles away from the Berkeley campus in West Oakland.
I would like to see this city rebuilt. I would like to see stuff like this fixed, holes in the ground. I would like to see my people not struggling no more.
Walking around his neighborhood, he says it's pretty much been the same his whole life, no matter who's president. Lots of poverty, too much violence, and decaying infrastructure.
To me, if a president say he gonna do something, I would say start on the places that really need it. Because you got places like this that's hopeless, that's going under.
Clayton didn't want to vote because he didn't expect it to change anything. But his grandma kept working on him, telling him one vote can really make a difference. And he surprised even himself and cast a ballot, though he says he doubts Obama will be able to make the changes he promised. Research shows that once young people vote, they're more likely to keep voting for the rest of their lives.
This is a political group that needs to be courted and engaged and listened to, and policies need to be put in place that serve their needs. And if you do that, they'll support you.
That's Felicia Sullivan, the youth polling expert we heard from earlier.
There are 46 million of them. That is 7 million more people than our senior citizens in this country.
In Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, Sullivan's group Circle calculates that if just half the youth voted differently or not at all, we'd be talking about President-elect Romney instead of President Obama. For Cross Currents, I'm Sarah Quevedo.
That piece was produced by Youth Radio in Oakland. We'll put a link to their many stories and programs at KALW.org. And if you're a first or second time voter, how engaged were you in this election? Will you still participate in the future? You can let us know at our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. You can just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your story on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. In California, last week's vote was in many ways a referendum on our criminal justice system. Voters rejected Proposition 34, and so the state's death penalty will remain in place. But California's also amended the so-called three strikes law so that nonviolent offenders are less likely to spend their whole lives in prison. That second vote suggests that people may be starting to think more about rehabilitation than punishment. For California, any focus on rehabilitation at all is fairly new. For almost 30 years, beginning in the late 70s, the state maintained a strict tough-on-crime stance. The California Department of Corrections, as it was then called, eliminated most of its educational and work programs. Jean Bracey, who currently oversees adult education at Folsom State Prison, says,
"You know, we call them the hook 'em, book 'em years."
After the state passed the controversial three strikes law in the mid-1990s, California's incarceration system became infamous for its high recidivism rates and overcrowding. In 2005, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger started re-emphasizing rehabilitation. He even added rehabilitation back into the Department of Corrections name. But Bracey says many of the fundamental problems remain.
Years ago, we locked up people we were afraid of. Today, we lock up people that we're mad at. You know, and so you have a lot of men that are not violent. Substance abuse plays a major role, you know, but we need to address those substance abuse, you know, issues in another way. Locking them up isn't the way to address it.
Today, prison officials have $460 million for rehabilitation efforts, nearly twice as much as they've had in the past. KALW's Kyunjin Lee visited Folsom State Prison to see how that money is changing things.
42-year-old Johnny Ames is determined to make this stint in prison his last. He started taking classes a couple of years after he arrived at Folsom State Prison, about 5 years ago. So right now, he's going after his associate's degree in humanities, and he's an apprentice in the vocational welding program. When I meet him, he's working on a project outside, behind one of the classrooms.
People do change. You know, prison saved me. And I know that since I started learning, it's expanded my mind and the way I look at things, people, issues, everything.
Although he got his GED before prison, he says he never liked going to school. On the inside, he had a hard time getting into a groove.
But I've been steady at it. Now it's just I'm finally wrapping my head around being able to sit, learn, and absorb. It takes work, but you know, no one in my family has ever gotten a college degree. So it'd be nice, even though my mom or my family could say, even though my brother was in prison, you know, he went to college and he got a degree.
I meet Jean Bracey in her office near the prison's front gates.
When we are not present, Mr. Snyder, one of our officers, our education officers, they will search the areas to make sure there's no contraband or anything inappropriate or any manufactured weapons or anything like this.
She's the principal of the adult school, and she's actually been a prison educator for 25 years. She says education is just one part of rehabilitation.
But they also need to be able to manage their lives, whether it's substance abuse, anger, and they need to be able to have a trade where they can go out and be marketable. They need to be able to walk out of prison and go into a society that's not necessarily going to, you know, shake their hand and welcome them back because, you know, they've kind of screwed up.
We hop into a golf cart and drive from one end of the prison to the other to visit the welding program. It's one of many. There's also landscaping, office maintenance, and a car repair class.
Wow, you have a little bit of everything
yes,
here.
Yes, this is the hybrid that was donated.
We pass the administrative building, then go up a hill and through another set of security gates.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
My name's Kyungjin. I'm a radio reporter in San Francisco.
Kyungjin, nice to meet you. Rob Purvis. Come on in, you guys.
Thank you.
Come on in.
Rob Purvis has been teaching welding at Folsom for 16 years. He uses a nationally developed curriculum, which means students leave his class with industry-accepted certificates.
So they go to a job site, applying for a job as a welder. It's not just them saying, well, I've done a little welding, I know how to weld. They say, I'm an AWS-certified welder, and I can weld this number of thicknesses in this number of positions, or I'm a pipe welder, et cetera, et cetera.
AWS stands for American Welding Society. They're a national trade group.
Can't find a job as a welder, you better call me up. We'll bend over backwards to get these guys hired, because we believe in the product.
Purvis says investing in rehabilitation is well worth it.
I would say these guys, as a rule, are much more highly motivated. Basically, when they get to these VOC programs, it's kind of an unwritten rule amongst the inmates. They leave their little differences down on the yard.
That's certainly the case for inmate Johnny Ames. This is his second time in prison, and he says drugs played a major role in both cases. So, in addition to the welding and college classes, he's gotten involved with recovery programs. And as far as work goes, he's been applying himself. He now manages the tool room and helps teach other inmates. And by the time he gets out, he'll be able to weld lying on his back, reaching around columns, and even using a mirror.
I look forward to coming to work. You know, when you come up here, it's like you're not even in prison for a minute. You know, you get to do weld and help other people, and it makes you feel like a normal person.
Both Bracey and Purvis say the more education and vocational training an inmate has, the less likely he is to come back to prison. But their experience is difficult to confirm because the state doesn't track the recidivism rate for inmates in these programs. They don't even have a system to do that. But at least one independent study shows prison programs can reduce recidivism rates between 5 and 9%. Johnny Ames says when he gets out, he'll be ready.
Prison isn't going to be the defining moment of my life. You know what I mean? It isn't going to be define who I am. You know, it's just going to be when I get all these other programs done, it's going to say, well, hey, you know, he took advantage of prison. You know, the prison didn't take advantage of him.
Most state prisons don't have a lot of new programs available yet, but CDCR hopes to have them up and running by this time next year. In Folsom, I'm Kyungjin Lee for Cross Currents.
You'll find a link to that story and all of our criminal justice reporting at our website. It's kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. There's another group of Californians having trouble finding work. Are veterans. Veterans Association studies have found that 1 in 5 returning vets suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. And a local study conducted right here at the San Francisco VA Medical Center finds that only about 10% of those vets seek treatment at a VA hospital. The San Francisco VA is trying some innovative strategies to reach more veterans. In this piece from our archives, reporter Sam Harnett takes us inside of one treatment program.
Vietnam veteran Howie Slater describes himself as a walking time bomb.
I'm originally from New York, and I was drafted in 1967. And I was in Cochi, Vietnam, so I did see my somewhat share of combat.
Slater was 22 when he returned from Vietnam. Something in him had changed. He felt anxious, disconnected from friends and family. He moved to the West Coast. He joined the anti-war movement, cut himself off from the Veterans Association, and tried to lose his memories. Instead, he lost his wife. Howie Slater lived with PTSD for 38 years before seeking treatment.
Even now, I might not seem anxious being around people because I'm a bit talkative, but I actually get into more of an anxious mode. And in the last 5 years, I've been back involved in the VA and have started to deal with life.
Now, once a week, Slater joins other vets at the Presidio YMCA. They work out together in a recreational therapy program coordinated by the San Francisco Veterans Association. Most are in their mid to late 60s, and each one has a story of anxiety, depression, alcoholism, family, and physical deterioration.
Yeah, I mean, this looks good. This looks really good. Because I know it's been difficult for you.
you know, in the last few weeks, just trying to get back on saddle again.
Very difficult, you know.
Recreational therapist Chris Geronimo is helping veteran Anton Souza on a weight machine.
It's good extension. Good.
When this generation of vets return from the battlefields, they face limited treatment options, mostly drugs and talk therapy.
More than a few times, these guys, these Vietnam era guys, have mentioned how they wish this type of program and therapy was available, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Howie Slater says the program helps him diffuse better than sitting in a circle, talking, or taking medication.
This has been a wonderful opportunity for me to come here and sort of tone down the powder keg that some of us walk around with.
PTSD is something veterans have walked around with since antiquity. Herodotus recorded the mental trauma in soldiers at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. During the First and Second World Wars, doctors referred to it as shell shock and started treating veterans with drugs.
This is all going to go away as I give you this medicine. No bother at all.
That's a clip from Let There Be Light, John Huston's 1946 documentary about World War II veterans. Doctors are trying to unlock buried memories by giving the veterans sodium amytal, a barbiturate known today as a truth serum. While it is no longer used to treat PTSD, it has been used experimentally to make witnesses talk. Defense attorneys have used statements delivered under sodium amytal to prove the innocence of their clients.
As a surgeon probes for a bullet, the psychiatrist explores the submerged regions of the mind, attempting to locate and bring to the surface the emotional conflict which is the cause of the patient's distress.
PTSD was only formally recognized as a mental disorder by the American Psychiatric Association in 1980. Modern-day treatments still focus on accessing and reprocessing traumatic memories. In 1981, Bay Area doctor Francine Shapiro developed a new therapy called EMDR, or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. The treatment combines physical stimulation and talk therapy.
You ask the person to identify the image that's been bothering them and the thoughts that have been bothering them.
Then you add bilateral stimulation.
Either taps or tones or eye movement generally, and that helps. All of this together helps to activate the brain's information processing system, and then you just allow your brain to go wherever it needs to go. You allow whatever associations that need to come up.
Shapiro, who practices in Watsonville, has seen good results in her patients. Still, she admits that what actually happens neurologically is far from clear.
There is no known mechanism, proven mechanism, for any form of therapy in terms of brain changes, or for that matter, for most pharmaceuticals.
Because so little is known about how PTSD actually works, new treatments take years to develop and test. It was only in 2004, after 24 years of studies, that the VA and Department of Defense endorsed EMDR. Meanwhile, young, damaged vets continue to suffer. And the longer they go untreated, the more intractable their symptoms become. Dr. William Wolf directs the PTSD program at the San Francisco VA.
For meeting up with somebody who's younger, where the trauma was recent, or older, where the trauma is recent, you know, we have a better chance that things are going to be resolved more quickly.
The San Francisco VA provides many traditional approaches to PTSD: group therapy, substance abuse programs, and cognitive behavioral therapy, the process of thinking through traumatic experiences. But to connect with young veterans, the VA is trying something novel: virtual reality.
It is a fully realized three-dimensional simulation of a world in which the veteran interacts, wearing a helmet, motion sensors, so responsive to the direction that they're looking, stereo headphones so that the sounds are in the appropriate places, even takes place on a platform that can vibrate and simulate. A lot of our veterans have traumatic experiences in a Humvee, so that can be simulated.
Virtual Iraq was adopted from the first-person shooting game, Full Spectrum Hero. The simulation returns a veteran to combat for a 30 to 45-minute session of prolonged exposure therapy. Choppers whir overhead, IEDs explode underneath Humvees, and bad guys jump out from behind broken-down buildings on realistic Baghdad streets. It's a video game, but therapists control the scenarios, allowing vets to relive specific traumatic situations. By simulating these memories, therapists hope to desensitize them.
Men and women who are coming back now, they grew up on video games. This is something that's natural for them. So it seems like a great thing to explore.
But even with new treatments, veterans fail to get help. A 2010 study conducted by the San Francisco VA found that fewer than 10% of vets with PTSD who served in Iraq or Afghanistan received treatment at a veterans hospital. VA Dr. Keith Armstrong says that many veterans still don't utilize VA healthcare.
If you're young, you don't really think about what you're eligible for when you leave the military, especially when it comes to the VA. I think, you know, that you're more interested in kind of getting on with your life, and I think people in general don't want to think about, well, what happens if you get sick?
Armstrong directs an outreach program that put a VA mental health clinic directly onto the campus at San Francisco City College. The aim of the program is to bring the VA to young veterans instead of waiting for veterans to come to the VA. But even with early intervention, PTSD is more often than not a lifelong problem.
We have to take a long view.
Again, Dr. William Wolf with the San Francisco VA.
Somebody drops out of treatment for a while. We want them to understand that we're here and we're ready for them to come back when they're ready. And that this is a process.
Back at the Presidio YMCA, the workout session is winding down. Howie Slater lifts weights and Anton Souza uses the elliptical. Out in an otherwise empty rec room, Vietnam vet Ralph Parker hits a punching bag. It isn't a solution for his PTSD, but he says it helps him deal with the day-to-day.
You know, throw some kicks, some punches, some elbows, you know, not in an angry way. Just, you know, throw my whole body at the bag. I always feel better. That's one thing about coming here. I feel better than I did when I came, every time I show up.
In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Cross Currents.
You can find all of our stories at kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Our next story comes to us from San Francisco StoryCorps.
My name is Slobodan Dan Pajic. I'm 65 years of age. I was born in Belgrade in Yugoslavia immediately after the Second World War. And Belgrade was bombed by everyone. Everything was literally gray, from food to clothes to people. People were sort of numbed and hardworking, and there was very little joy, or at least, you know, in my environment. But my mother took me to the opera when I was five, and it was Tosca, and we were late. So when we got to the theater, they took us to the top of the theater, because that's where the latecomers go, and they let us in. And I looked down, all the way down, and suddenly there was color. It was, you know, the first act of Tosca, and it's sort of in some church, sort of, it's a Baroque setting. And I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, the real life is there. This is just a mistake, which needs to be corrected. So this impression of the real color and real life kind of stayed with me.
That piece comes to us from San Francisco's StoryCorps, and it was produced by Carolina Hidalgo. San Francisco StoryCorps is based at the Contemporary Jewish Museum of San Francisco. And that's it for today's Cross Currents. The team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Artyom Skunahofs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. Also thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear about the invasive frog that's taken over a San Francisco pond.
These are cheap toy-looking amphibians with enormous hind claws and fat legs tapering into a simple wedge of a body.
Why those frogs aren't toys. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
I feel so good inside of you. Your gentle warmth will pull me through.
You're hearing the futuristic sounds of Cross Currents favorites, the Phenomenauts. They're playing at the Uptown Nightclub in Oakland on Wednesday, along with glam rock standbys, the Rizzillos, plus an additional unannounced guest. Music starts about 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.